And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Julia Claiborne Johnson, who's a former journalist for Glamour and Mademoiselle. She's recently published her hilarious debut novel, Be Frank With Me, where a publishing industry assistant is dispatched to Los Angeles to keep an eye on a reclusive genius author and her unusual son, Frank. Julia, the narrator of Be Frank With Me, is Alice Whitley. She's a 24-year-old from Nebraska, and she's had the most improbable route into the world of publishing.
Well, it's not that improbable. I used to work at Glamour when I was young, among many other places, and I had a boss there. You might know how Mimi has that list of the people that she want interview, mm-hmm. like no Ivy Leaguers or English majors or stuff like that. That was her list because, not all of it, but part of it, because she wanted somebody who was going to work hard and didn't feel like they were entitled to stuff. So she went for people like Alice, who like were from Nebraska and had had a different, like a well-rounded, let's say, background, but who still loved books. So she was like, for somebody like that, she was the ideal employee. And also her boss had not gone to some fancy college too, so he was drawn to her because of that.
SUNY New Paltz?
SUNY New Paltz, which is an excellent school, but it's not Harvard or like Yale, where my husband went. I think there's a real... when you recognize what you found in yourself when you were young in another person, that's who you want. You don't want the other people who somebody else has rubber stamped for you. So,
her background is accounting and art, fine art.
Right, because she kind of wanted to be an artist, but her mother was very practical and said you have to... like when I worked at Mademoiselle, it was hysterical. All the editors, because I started out as an assistant, had all gotten degrees in dental hygiene, so they'd have something to fall back on. And so I was like, that is such brilliant parenting, because you just never know how things are going to work out. So they were these high-powered Manhattan editors who, like, if you had a tooth crisis, could leap into the breach. So
I think we should all be double-trained like
that. Don't you think? And then when the zombies come, you are ready. So
Scott Adams, who draws Dilbert...
oh, I love cartoonists.
...once said, I'm in the top 80% of... cartoonist as a drawer.
Uh-huh.
And I'm probably in the top 80% as being a funny guy.
Uh-huh.
And you put those two together,
that's
great.
How it works.
Because you can succeed that way, mm-hmm. or by being like in the top 1%.
Well, my very first job in New York City was working for a cartoon syndicate. I was in the sales department, and it was Peanuts and Lucy.
Was it United?
It was United Feature Syndicate. And Garfield was big when I was there. So, and I had worked in a magazine at Mademoiselle, as I said, as a writer later after I was an assistant. And I was fascinated by the art people because they could just like spit stuff out while they were talking to you, which I was just like, that is the coolest thing ever. So that's why I made Alice be an artist, a drawer or a person.
So was it pretty unfunny to work with funny people?
When I worked at Mademoiselle?
No, at United Features.
Oh, at United Features. Well, we were the bean counters. So I was like mailed out, like I did the billing for like... I think I had the Midwest and California, so I would just type out things. So they weren't that funny, but if somebody, like Miss Manners would come into the office, and it was like a cause for much excitement.
Did you make a faux pas in front of Judith Martin?
No, I did not, but you know, she was really funny, I think, so people really liked her. And it was interesting because I can't remember what they call it, the people who made the plush toys that they sold, licensing, they were very snooty to the rest of us because they knew they were the money makers, and we were just like, you know, those people in the office over there. So it was kind of funny to me. So there's always a hierarchy in every office.
As the book does open up, we're in medias res.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a station wagon on fire. Mm-hmm. We hear about a station wagon on fire. Mm-hmm. Why do you decide to...
to start that way?
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. There's this excellent book called A Visit from the Goon Squad. Have you ever read that one?
It won the Pulitzer.
Yeah, and it has a really like bang up start because the girl sees like somebody's purse with her wallet hanging out of it, and she's trying to decide if she should steal it or not because she's a little bit of a kleptomaniac. And then so you're instantly interested. And so I was like, oh, I need an opening like that. And I have a weakness for explosions. Not personally, but my husband used to write Beavis and Butthead, and they blew stuff up all the time. I've never blown anything up myself, and I've never set anything on fire that wasn't supposed to be set on fire. But
fire is a theme in the book.
Fire is a theme in the book, because like part of the reason fire is a theme in the book, you don't have children, do you?
No.
Okay. The thing about having children that nobody prepares you for is the carnage that comes with it, because if you look away for a second, like they can set the house on fire, or like they can drown in the bathtub, or they can, like, somebody's always getting cut, or they're vomiting or needing stitches or crying because they're in so much pain. And that was usually me or my husband, but I just wasn't ready for it. And to me, that was why there was all that sort of terror of imminent apocalypse. You know, because, you know, how Frank knocks his mother through the glass door. Glass door, yeah. I would say to Chris, if I survive our children's youth, it will be a miracle, because I was just covered with bruises all the time because they were clumsy.
It seems like you got out of it.
I got
all
out
right.
of it, yeah. They're both in college now, so.
Well, they still got a few more years.
Yeah, there's still time. Well,
Frank said 25 when your prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's funny because we came home from something when they were teenagers and they were big enough for you to leave at home alone. And we walked in the front door and the house smelled like fire. And I was like, what's going on? And my daughter said, I made a piece of toast and the toaster caught on fire. And I turned to my husband. I said, yeah, it's funny. We always thought my son would be the one that burned the house down.
Isaac Vargas is Alice's primary boss.
Yeah.
And he's an important literary editor. And his biggest author is one who hasn't turned in a book for 30 years.
Right.
What does the world know about M.M. Banning? Because she's very reclusive.
We live in Hollywood. We've lived there for 20 years. And you kind of don't understand what a weird thing it is to be famous, particularly if you were an inner kind of a person, because we have friends who are actors. And they'll be walking down the street, and suddenly somebody will jump and go, oh my God, I love you so much. And it's not even me. And it's terrifying. And they want nothing but good, you know. They're so thrilled to see the person that they've had such a, you know, a deep feelings for. But if you're not used to it, it's a weird thing. And so that was part of why I had her be so reclusive. And it's just so fascinating to me how, like, you can do one thing really well. And then there's performance anxiety because you don't know how the next one's going to be received. I'm feeling that very deeply right now. So.
You just can't enjoy it now.
Yeah. No, I actually am enjoying it now. But a lot of people said, are you working on another book? And I'm like, I just finished this one, you know. So, and it took forever. It took me from the start of me writing it until that it arrived on bookstore shelves. It was 6 years, because it takes a year for the editing once they finish it and they have to print it up and everything. But we were in Nashville last week and I was in Parnassus Books and I was just walking down the aisle and I looked over and I saw my book on the bookshelf and I went, because it's just so weird that it exists.
Because you're there to
I'm there
sell
and
your
I
book.
Like didn't, nobody was showing it to me. Like I just, like, there it was, you know. They all laughed at me at the bookstore and they said, it's over here. It's right there, you know, but it was, I felt like I'd captured it in the wild when I saw it that way.
But you had your own celebrity sighting when you were in Nashville.
I did. I saw Ann Patch. I met her and I chatted with her. They introduced me to her and they said, and this is Ann. And I was like, hi, Ann. Oh my God. So it was the same thing. I was just as like gushy and I was trying really hard not to slobber, but I got through it.
So have you gone through any practicing people recognizing you when you walk down the street? Have you had any fantasies along that line?
I can't imagine it would happen. But, you know, I went to my publishers in New York. They had me come in to do some media stuff. And I went in to meet the publicity team. And this woman looked up at me and went, hi. And I was like, oh, my God, she knows what I look like because she see the picture. It's very weird. So I can't imagine that a lot of people can. But that's why being a writer is such a good kind of fame. Not that I'm ever going to be famous like that, but you sort of have a little bit of anonymity left, which has got to be a relief. But the first time I saw somebody with one of my books, and this was really right as it got published, I was on an elevator, and this woman had a copy of my book, and I went, I wrote that book. Do you want me to sign it? And then I opened it and showed it that my picture was there so she wouldn't think I was a random crazy person. And she's like, yes. And she's like, and so I'm signing it. She's like, this is so exciting. I said, let me tell you something. However exciting it is for you, it is not nearly as exciting as it is for me. So
please don't start stalking your fans.
I will try not to. But, you know, when I worked at magazines, I would see people reading a magazine and they'd be paging through it and I could see them come into something I'm about to write. And I'd be like, watch it. And they just keep on going. And I was like, no. So it was pretty gratifying to see somebody actually read or about to read.
Well, and this has got to be much more gratifying because someone may have bought that magazine for the hot fall lipstick colors.
Well, that's what they did.
And this, they bought an entire 300-page book for you.
I know, exactly. And perhaps my mother knows them and I encourage them to do so, but maybe not. So.
So with M.M. Banning, who's known as Mimi, being a reclusive author, we get a lot of Harper Lee in there and a little bit of Salinger and maybe some Pynchon in there, too.
And it's interesting because I was talking to somebody this morning who said, did you know about the whole Harper Lee, the second book thing? And I was like, no, man, my book was sold and they were editing it. And then my agent sent me the thing from Publishers Weekly talking about Go Set a Watchman was about to come out. And it was crazy. I was like, I am prophetic, you know. But it is like that. If you really love a writer and then they don't write another book, like that's all you it's like the guy who doesn't call you back after the first date. You're just like, why aren't they calling? Why aren't they writing me another book? So
see, I'm kind of weird because when I read a book I really, really love, I'm afraid to read the next
book. The next one? Oh, interesting.
And it's like with TV shows, you know, like I loved Homicide, Life on the Streets.
I did too. Oh, my gosh.
And I couldn't watch The Wire because I thought it would affect my memory of The Wire.
It's so good. You've got to watch it.
I know, but I loved Homicide so much, and it's such a similar kind of setting.
I watched them both, so I can tell you. The Wire gets off to a slightly slow start, but man, once it's going, it is Shakespearean. And I was just talking about this to Chris's, my husband's friend this morning. Like, I run on the treadmill and watch shows. That was like my break from writing. And when I was watching The Wire, I would run 10 miles so I could watch two episodes back to back. And so I'd be running along, you know, and then something big would happen. I'd go, no! And everybody at the gym would turn and look at me. I was like, it's The Wire. I'm watching The Wire. So you got to watch it.
Let's talk about the motivations behind these second books in quite some time is quite different for Harper Lee than it is for Mimi.
Oh, yeah, because she...
And it seems that she fell victim to like a Bernie Madoff type.
She did fall victim to a Bernie Madoff thing. And then I had read about Annie Leibovitz who mortgaged her copyrights, which was terrifying to me, like, because that's everything she had.
Well, and Jacqueline Mitchard had lost money in a big...
And then did she mortgage her copyrights, too?
I don't know how she dug out of the hole. But
well, you know, to me...
But she lost it in a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, no, it's the same kind of thing. And, like, a lot of artists, you will be shocked to hear this, are not excellent money managers. And you're just so victim to something like that. And then that she redoubled her bad choice by mortgaging her copyright, which was going to leave her destitute. So I was like, she really can't get into a worse pickle than this. Because I wanted to really make it be sort of life and death for her. And because she had a kid who was very set in his ways and didn't like change, it was really important for her to stay in her house in a way that it might not be for somebody else. So,
and it's a fabulous house in Bel Air.
Yes.
And for someone that wants privacy, a big house with glass walls.
What was she thinking? Oh, my God. But the thing is, it was because it was there were two reasons she bought it. It was the most expensive house on the market when she bought it, and she was like 25. So it was her way of thumbing her nose at the world. And also she knew her mother would hate it. And she had a real, as many daughters who were very different from their mother, they had kind of a thing. Because, you know, remember Alice says to her, did your mother ever see it? And she's like, says she's been dead for years, but I hear her complaining about it all the time. That seemed very funny to me. So
any difficulties in your family life either?
No, my mother is delightful. She is a doctor and everybody loves her to pieces. And so it was when she retired, because she's 87, when she retired, people were like rending their clothes and sobbing, go, don't let her retire. I was like, she's old. You know? But she's great. There were two women in her medical school class when she went to medical school. So she was a real trailblazer.
Alice has been employed by Isaac Vargas to help out Mimi as a personal assistant during this time. She's got to write a new book to get money back because property taxes are pretty hellish out in California.
Yes, they are. I don't know. How did you know?
I've heard.
I don't know if you remember The Exchange. I remember all of this book very because I spent so much time writing it.
You're different from a lot of authors.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess as time goes by, you forget more. But I had
to
write. They're
working on their second or third
things.
Book after.
And I'm just sitting back reading movie magazines and eating chocolates. So, but she says to Isaac, who knew her back when, I have bad judgment. You need to send me somebody to help me who will really help me. And you know, she knows how to use a computer. Mimi does. But she writes on a typewriter that had belonged to her brother because she has a deep emotional tie to that story, which was her first book was sort of based on her brother. So that's why she writes on a typewriter. But then if you've typed something up, you don't want to enter it into the computer. You want somebody else to enter it into the computer. This comes from my magazine writing days when you'd have to interview somebody and you're like, oh, I don't want to have to type that up again. She just needed somebody who was going to be a voice of reason, but she also didn't need somebody who was a voice of reason. And so she and Alice are kind of at loggerheads because of that.
Mimi just really doesn't want Alice there, but
she knows she needs her. Yeah, that's the thing.
And that makes things very difficult. I mean, when you don't want someone, but you need them, the friction is terrible.
It's terrible. And the other thing, too, is like Alice is exactly the age that Mimi was when she hit it big, and her whole life is in front of her. And so that just vexes the heck out of Mimi, too, because she's just like, you don't know anything. Like, this, and she doesn't say it to her, but it's all like running through her brain every time she looks at her. All she can think of was, I used to be you.
And that antagonism manifests itself by her calling Alice Penny. the least valuable of the coins.
Yes. Did you notice that?
I said it out loud. I guess yeah. I did.
Yeah. But it's funny, too, because like it made me laugh. Because a lot of times, I feel ridiculous saying this, but a lot of the things I wrote made me laugh when I do it. Because like the fact that when you put a penny in your mouth, it really does taste terrible. And Alice has put a bad taste in her mouth. And that, so that was part of the penny thing, too. But oh, there are many symbols. Many symbols.
It's almost like you planned something.
I know. Well, it's funny because I have a friend who is very smart and extremely suave. I call him Cary Grant to his wife because he just exudes all of that. And he's like, I have an English student question to ask you. And I was like, bring it on. And he said, Mimi writes a book called The Pitcher. And I wondered if it was a reference to Catcher in the Rye. And I was like, no. I wish I'd thought of that. But my brother was a pitcher for the high school baseball team, and it's the only sport I know anything about. And also, it's a fairly solitary thing, which if you're on a team and you're kind of a loner, that's the obvious choice, as far as I know, since I only know about baseball. So,
well, and when we were talking before the interview and now, there are little bits of your life that you've used as material in here.
Well, I think everybody does that. I mean, you know, what else do you know other than, I don't know about you, but I have an interior monologue going all the time. And I said to my husband once, what is your interior monologue saying? He goes, what? And I said, you know, the interior monologue, the little voice that's always in your head. He's like, I don't think I have one. And so I guess it's just white noise in some people's minds. But he's a super genius. Maybe he doesn't need to think through everything. For example, one of my friends, when she moved out to L.A., she stayed with us for 6 months before she got her own apartment so she could get to know the neighborhoods. And so she read my book when it was the advance copy, the paperback they send out to the bookstores, because she wanted to wait till it was pretty much done. And she read it, and she came in, and she said, Mimi is mean you, and Alice is nice you. And I started laughing. I was like, you are exactly right. Because, so, I mean, it's the two halves of myself. Because now that I'm old and tired and have been through so much, I can understand extreme crankiness in a way that I didn't when I was 25. And when I was 25, I was such a good parent. I had not had children, but the fact that I had recently been a child made me something of an authority on the subject. And then, like, when you do have kids, you realize, oh, I had no idea. I had no idea what I was talking about.
But unlike Mimi, you give interviews.
That's true. Mimi is a little less of a chatter than I am, but that is not saying much. So.
Well, and she's also still hounded by overzealous fans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, can you imagine? That would be so weird. And I was really fascinated with the Salinger angle of that, because like people would like go up to his house, you know, and like hunt him down. And like that just seems great. And particularly now when they can try to find you on the internet. And there are a lot of houses in L.A., probably not as much as there used to be, that weren't on maps because they just hadn't been set on the map. So when she bought that house, it was not on a map. But now, of course, it is. So it's all very interesting to me. Let me tell you more about me.
Well, that's what we're here for.
I know, exactly.
So one of the main reasons that she does need an assistant with Alice is because she has a 9-year-old son named Frank. And Frank is what they say, was it sui generis?
He's the only one. Is that what sui generis means? I know.
He's one of a kind.
Yeah, one of a kind. He is one of a kind, but he's so delightful to me. You know, when I was young, I told you I worked at Mademoiselle magazine. It was a Condé Nast magazine, so like Vogue and Glamour. We were all in the same building. And it was super fascinating to me because, you know, I was a good little student who made straight A's and, you know, went to college and everything. And then I got this job working in the fiction department at Mademoiselle. And later, I was a copywriter, so I would write the things like, the best skirt length for this year is whichever one looks good on you, you know, like really gems like that. But I was fascinated by the people in the fashion department, some of whom were very smart, like Kate Spade was a fashion assistant when I worked there, and others of them were stupendously fabulous. And you'd talk to them because you had to write their fashion copy, and they'd talk and talk and talk, and then about 5 minutes in, you'd think, they haven't made a bit of sense yet. It made me realize they're different kinds of genius, and they were sartorial geniuses. And then there was me, not that I was a genius, but I was used to academic achievement, so it was a whole different world. So I always thought about Frank as sort of like if Karl Lagerfeld and Diana Vreeland had had a baby. That's Frank.
Yeah, but Lagerfeld dresses very plainly himself.
But he has kind of a uniform and a look, you know, and Frank is...
But Frank, he enjoys changing the look up.
Well, he's obsessed with the old movies. And the thing about Frank, too, another reason he's really taken with old movies is, like, the world is very baffling to him because he's very smart. You know, he says more than once, I'm more intelligent than 99.7% of the American populace, but he doesn't have people skills. And so he loves to watch movies over and over and over because you know what's going to happen in the movie. Like, there are no surprises. And the surprises of interpersonal interactions are what really throw him for a loop because he just can't figure people out. Because he's learning people skills from the movies, he's also learning dressing skills for the movies. So you can't blame him. Because those guys in those black and white movies, they could dress.
But with some of the behaviors that Frank has, you know, it's easy to imagine that he's on the autism Asperger spectrum. So.
Okay, well, we can talk about that. Here's the thing. I have a daughter named Coco, and she was reading To Kill a Mockingbird. It was about 6 years ago because it was right before I started. And I reread it when she reread it because I hadn't read it since I was 13. And so I read it with her, and then I was like, oh, you know, because I'm a grown-up with children, and it's the 21st century. I was like, oh, Boo Radley must have some form of autism, which had never occurred to me. And then I was like, oh, and I thought of all the characters in fiction. That character's always been there. People just didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And so my next thought was, well, it's a lot easier to write that character than it is to raise him. And so that's why Mimi's a writer, because she's written that character and then she has to raise him. At the same time, I was very adamant about not labeling him, because labels give you a handle, but then they also limit you. It's not a textbook that I've written. It is a work of fiction. So I wanted you to think of just Frank, not of all the other people. And my editor said, are you sure about this? And I said, this is the one thing I'm sure about. I'm sure about many things, like, you know, mayonnaise, I don't like it. So, but, you know, stuff like that. So I was pretty adamant about not giving him any kind of diagnosis, because in the old days in fiction, they didn't have it. So, and this is sort of
and
a tribute.
And this book does go for more of a timeless feel.
Yeah, it's a tribute to yesteryear, so.
But some of his behaviors, he's got dysgraphia. He's a terrible speller and handwriting, which is common for people on the spectrum. He looks at Alice's eyebrow while she's talking instead of seeing the totality of emotion on her face. He has to be educated by his psychologist to help him know what facial expressions mean.
Yeah, exactly. I did a lot of research. I read a ton of books about stuff like that, and it was interesting. Because when you read all this stuff, then you start thinking, oh, I see this character. So my mother, as I said, is a doctor who has completely illegible handwriting. She is not anywhere on the spectrum. But then there are a lot of and you have to memorize so much stuff in medical school, and people who are on the spectrum are often quite brilliant at that. But a lot of them don't have bedside manner. And so I was like, oh, I bet a lot of doctors have this, because you can't read their handwriting and they stare at your eyebrow while they're talking to you. So stuff like that. It was all very interesting to me how these things were tied. You're giving me a furrowed look.
No, that's called thinking.
Oh, okay.
You've been in Los Angeles so much, you haven't,
really
seen people encumbered by that, by thought. Because I was
thinking, your forehead still moves. That was what threw me.
There was some discussions about women in technology and programming computers a couple of years ago. And I was wondering at the time, I said, well, since that's such a concentrated thing, then people have to be in a zone to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe people who are on the spectrum are better suited to excel at that.
Right, because they can cut out the rest of the world.
And more men are on the spectrum than women are, comparatively.
It's because girls can hide it better. Because, like, a quiet girl who, like, just puts her head down and does her work is is more accepted than it is with a guy. They think, what's wrong with this kid? Why is he not, you know, doing whatever? And boys, you know, talk a lot. I don't know if you know this.
Well, I'm in that job, so I want people to talk a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know how I had that joke in there? There's a bunch of jokes in there because Frank is trying to learn how to tell jokes as a way to bond with people. And
there's
the joke in there, which I love, about the outgoing mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, how he looks at your shoes instead of his own shoes. So that was in there because of that. And, you know, I read that book, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, mm-hmm. which they made into a spectacular play because they were able to visualize all the things he's doing. But part of it, of why Frank is a more flamboyant and not a math kid, is because I think that's often what the kids who are in this pickle are. But from my knowledge of the fashion people, that's one too. So I thought that would be a more fun thing to have.
And he's in Los Angeles. So
he's in Los Angeles.
The film industry is right there, and it would capture
his imagination. Oh, yeah. And his mother was peripherally involved in it. And, like, the movie work crew built the fence around her house. In our house, for example, it was a rehab. It was like a rotting, about-to-fall-down house that we fixed up. So they were about to put the windows in over the kitchen sink, and the architect realized he had changed the specs, but he hadn't changed it on the work order. And he had to put it in tomorrow. We had the next day, we had a very scary loan where if you didn't meet all your deadlines, they could take your house and all your money. But the rates were low. This is why I have Mimi loser money. But anyway, so he said, don't worry about it. I'll get Disney to build your windows because they could do it overnight. So that's why I have the joke in there about if they don't think Rome can be built in a day, they've never lived in Hollywood, because they went that night. About 5 o'clock, started those windows, and they were put in the next day. So it's kind of miraculous. So I don't know if that answered your question.
I can't even remember what my question was at that point.
I have a terrible feeling it had nothing to do with what I just told you.
Mimi had rules for the assistants she wanted. She wanted someone who wasn't an English major, not an Ivy Leaguer. Now Frank has rules for dealing with him on a daily basis, and there are two major rules.
Uh-huh. You cannot touch Frank, and you cannot touch Frank's things. But Frank can touch you. And Frank does this thing where he comes and puts his face against you a lot. And I don't know, I just thought that was really kind of funny. Because that's like so much more intimate than touching somebody with your hands. But he's like always plastering his face against people. And there were like rules within the rules. Like she could wash his clothes and hang him up. But once she took her hands off him, then she couldn't touch him again, she being Alice. You know, there's a part where they talk about how what's up with Frank, which is never said, has a genetic link. I think Mimi might have had a little of that business going on too. So, but she is much better than, not better is not the right word, but much more comfortable in the world than Frank is.
Well, and there is theories that when two really smart people get together, that their child being on the spectrum is higher.
Uh-huh. Oh, I believe it. Believe me.
Alice keeps notes. Who could not be in that situation and want to keep notes of living in one of the most famous writers in the world's house?
Mm-hmm.
And she has a little notebook with a unicorn on the front. So why a unicorn?
Did you notice that? I think it's a symbol. But also, when my kids were little and you'd go into the airport bookstore, the little notebooks always had a unicorn or like puppies or something on them. And she buys the notebook there. So that, and it had a, I don't know if you remember, there was a pack of crayons Velcro to the side of it. So that's literally why there's a unicorn on it. But then I was like, oh, I'm going to slip a symbol in here.
I also think she's trying to make Mimi underestimate her because she says, no, I haven't read your book.
Right.
And she's doing all this stuff to kind of.
Yeah, to put her at ease, but also to sort of get back at her. Get back is a uncharitable way of saying it, but to sort of assert herself in a way that she needs to do to keep her body and soul together, because she's just so mean to her. And, you know, Mr. Vargas, who was her boss back in New York, was just so nice to her that she wanted to make him happy. She probably would have left, but she didn't want to let him down.
There are a lot of parallels between Frank and Alice because they don't really know their fathers.
But you know who I think are the two, the same character sort of, are Xander and Frank. And Xander, we haven't talked about him yet, but he is the incredibly handsome and charming piano teacher. And he has let himself be hamstrung by the fact that he's always going to get by. People are always going to like him. He doesn't really have to try that hard. And they both have too much of something. Like, it's hard to have too much of something. I have managed to get through, okay?
With yeah, I mean, your excessive
you
beauty.
You too as well. Yes, oh my gosh, my incredible skinniness. And you hope that Frank will learn to corral his smarts and to be able to use it. But Xander has let it get away from him because he's just always going to skate by on his look. So in my head, they were kind of the same character, but not really. And to me, also, Alice and Mimi are kind of the same character, but not really. So, because I'm not very sophisticated, I was like, hey, I'm going to make these two mirror each other. So,
since Frank is obsessed with old Hollywood, for some reason, I keyed in on The Man Who Came to Dinner. Mm-hmm. And this book seems like almost an inversion, a mirror image of The Man Who Came to Dinner. So you have a woman coming to help a famous person.
Right, exactly.
And the people that are at the home are crazy, and it's the outsider who is the same person coming in.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's funny he never watches that movie in the book, because they did this great thing last week where they had a Oscars promotion for my book where you could win every movie he talks about in the book. And it was like a lot of movies. Yeah. So I was like, that is an awesome thing. I don't know who won it. But yeah, that's such a good movie. Sheldon Whiteside. Isn't that his name? The guy?
The character's name?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Shelley. Like, yeah, I think Shelley. Monty Woolley was the actor, right?
I think so. I can't remember. I haven't seen it in a million years. I've seen like high school productions of it much more recently. So.
And Alice was lucky in a sense that Frank at this point was obsessed with screwball comedies, and he had already worked through his gangster phase.
Yes, because his favorite movie for a while was White Heat. Frank would sneak up behind his mother. He didn't see it as sneaking up. He would walk up to her and yell, "Top of the world, Mom!" and make her jump out of her skin. But it's interesting because, like, when you have kids, when this happens to you, you'll find out you either have to watch like animated things or like the old movies. And so we watched a lot of screwball comedies. We didn't watch so many Jimmy Cagney ones, except when he was being a hoofer. So that I had a lot of them in my head, because we'd gone through a period of deep watching of all of them. And my son really loved Broadway Melody of 1939, which is Frank's favorite movie. We watched that movie a million times.
Just remembered this story from my childhood recently, and the Star Wars movie came out. And I saw Star Wars when it first came out, and I loved it. And I saw it 7 times in the theater. I loved it so much. And at that time, WTBS, Ted Turner's channel, the satellite channel, had just gotten big. And they had all these great movies to show. And my mom said, "Oh, 7 Brides for 7 Brothers is coming
that's
on.
Such a good
you
one.
Have to watch this." So I watched it. And afterwards, she said, "What do you think?" I said, "Even better than Star Wars."
That's fantastic. I love that. That's great.
Now, Mimi is always down on Alice. But sometimes Alice screws up. I mean, her use of language around Frank and saying crazy and stuff like that. She makes so many mistakes in her language in dealing with these people.
Well, yeah, because you get exasperated. If you ever have children, you will find yourself making similar mistakes, because like something will come out of your mouth sometime. You're like, no, I can't believe I just said that. And that's her journey that she's going through, is like she goes in there thinking, I have got this. I'm going to do an awesome job. And then she totally falls apart over the course of it, because she learns it's a lot harder than you think it's going to be. And so that's why she has slip-ups like that. Like in the world, back at Mr. Vargas's office, she would never say something like that. But if she was starved for sleep, and you get very exasperated, because if somebody has a different way of dealing with things, you can't understand what's happening with them, and it's just so frustrating. So,
Because Frank is very charming, but goodness, he needs constant vigilance around
him. Vigilance is a thing, yeah. So, and it's exhausting, because, you know, when you have a kid, you never get enough sleep. And it seems like they should let you sleep past daybreak. But alas, they do not, so.
And the fact that he's a bit of a magpie doesn't help either.
Oh, yeah, and he doesn't even see it as stealing at all. He just picks things up, and he's like, oh, this is fascinating, and he wanders off with it, never to be seen again. Chris has a friend who is a super genius, and we stayed in his apartment in Manhattan once while he was away. And in his apartment, there were, you know, those tools that have like 25 tools in them. There must have been 10 in his apartment, because he would have one. He would use it. He'd put it down. He couldn't remember where he put it down. So he'd get another one. So they were, and he'd have like 4 copies of one book, like all like laid open on a surface where he put it down and couldn't remember where he put it. So he just got another one. So I think that is often a distractible, super smart person. They're like, I got to think about more important things like world peace. I'll just go buy another one of these. So
I've got like 8 sets of nail clippers.
See, you know what I'm talking about.
I think I just lose things easily.
But that's why he just wanders off with it, because they're fascinating.
Now, there is a other building on the property, the Dream House.
I love the Dream House, and that just came to me from nowhere. Like, and I said to Chris, my husband, the other day, the Dream House was such a good idea as a name for it, because they're 2 different houses and you needed to tell them apart. And it was easy to do once I thought of it, because she goes in a lot of people have this in LA where they have a garage and then they'll have like a loft apartment or a real apartment, but this one's a loft.
Is that,
over.
Is that like the Cato?
The Cato thing, yeah. And so this one, for some reason, everything in it's painted yellow. And you know that painting of Van Gogh's bedroom at Arles? Mm-hmm. And they actually have made one, the Chicago Art Institute. It's like they copied it, and you can get in a raffle to spend the night there, and I'm dying to go. But anyway, so everything's painted yellow in this house because, as Frank said, somebody got a good deal on yellow paint, or maybe Alice's, I can't remember. Because everything's very tiny in it, too, because it's fitting in. Like, there's a refrigerator that looks like three drawers stacked in a kitchen, but you open it up, and it's got a refrigerator, and there's, like, a little cooktop that pulls out. And there are a ton of these in L.A., like, all these adorable tiny things, and they'll have, like, a tiny little bathroom. So she says of it, Barbie's dream house meets Van Gogh at Arles. And so, which I think I'm mispronouncing. But anyway, so they start calling it the dream house, and then I was like, oh, but that's really good. It, too, like the unicorn. Can work as a symbol. So,
well, and it's not up to code because it's got a really rickety access to it.
Oh my God, I know. They would totally shut her down. It's like a whole scam in LA where you just don't tell the lady before Mimi who built that house might have built it before there were codes. You could get away with more in the olden days and so many things.
One of Alice's jobs, she is supposed to retype Mimi's pages, but Mimi's not handing them over.
I know. What the heck? And so it's driving Alice crazy because she feels like she's here for this job. And that job never materializes. So it makes her feel like a failure. And that's part of what undermines her confidence a little bit, too, is she's not able to do the job she's supposed to do. But the job she ends up doing is so much more interesting. I don't know why she's upset. So.
When we were talking before, you said this is your first book. That you,
Isn't it crazy?
You didn't even have one in the desk.
No, I didn't have one in the desk because here's the thing. Like when I was young, I told you I worked at Mademoiselle and I worked for the fiction editor. And I was the person, the first set of eyeballs that went across 10,000 manuscripts every year. They were short stories to consider for publication. And so I had encountered a lot of different kinds of stories that weren't good for different reasons. And one of the types of not good story was beautiful writing, doesn't have a damn thing to say. And that's kind of a heartbreaking one, you know, because you think, oh my gosh, I can write so beautifully, but I have nothing to say. And that's how I felt like I was. I could write, I could put a sentence together, but I felt like there was nothing that the world was standing there going, oh, please tell me of your wisdom. And then I had the idea I told you about the Boo Radley thing, where I just thought, oh my God, that character's always been there. And it's so much harder to raise than to write. So that seemed like a real thing to me that would be interesting to people because it was interesting to me. Like, I had never read that book. I wanted to read that book. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to write it. So I wrote it, and it's funny because I was walking down my block. I was halfway down the block when it occurred to me. And by the time I got to the stop sign at the end of the block, like, the whole story had laid itself out for me, not in the particulars, but, like, that it was a writer. There would be a young person who thought she knew everything but didn't. There would be this nutty kid who was, like, different. And I knew what the last line was. But I didn't know how I was going to get there. And so it was always the last line the whole time I was writing it for all those 5 years. So I finally turned it in. And my editor said to me, it's a little harsh. It's not that harsh. She felt it was a little abrupt. And so she said, I really want you to write one more chapter. And I said, all right, I will. And then I wrote another chapter that has a different very last line. And after I wrote it, I was like, oh, this is the last line. This should have always been the last line. You can go to look later. If you have not read the book, you should not cheat. But you'll see why. Like, there's like a central question. That's the first last line. And then there's the, but this is really what you need to take away from this last line of the next one. Because I'm real deep.
Well, and it's been very well received and it's selling briskly. So,
I know, isn't that crazy?
So how do you feel about success?
Yeah. It is the weirdest thing ever. Like, my daughter's godmother was getting her hair blown out to go to some big event. She's like, I opened People magazine and there you were. And I was like, oh my God, I know, it's so exciting. And it's on the LA Times bestseller list. And my friend who sent it to me, because I'm on book tour and I didn't see the LA Times this weekend. So my friend, oh, I don't know if I should. Well, you can edit this out because it seems a little snotty when I say it. Anyway, my friend who sent it to me said, please notice that you are above Isabel Allende. I was like, yeah, you know how it is. So.
Well, you're new, you're fresh.
I am new and fresh, and I think that's a lot of the allure. I hope it's not all the allure, but I feel like for people, I'm in the second half of my first century. And so, like, for somebody like me to think that this could happen to you just seems crazy. And, like, to have people come up to you and go, oh, my God, I loved your book so much. It's just the craziest thing ever. And the woman who does events at Laurelwood Books here in Memphis, her name is Macon. When I realized I was going to be driving through, and I said, I know there's a really nice bookstore called Laurelwood. If they want me to come, I'll come and do something. And she said she was at some event, and they called her, and she almost burst into tears. She was so excited because she loved my book so much. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to start to cry, you know, because it's just weird because you spend so much time alone with it. And then suddenly it's like, huh. So, but it's like I was telling somebody this yesterday, when you have a baby, I keep coming back to this children thing, but my mother was in the delivery room when I got married. She was there too, but when I had my first child, it was a difficult birth and I was sure I was going to die and my poor husband was going to be alone. And my mother kept saying to me, now, Julia, as soon as that baby comes out, you're going to experience a feeling of relief like nothing you've ever felt. And, you know, I was like not buying that at that point. But then it came out and I was like, oh, that was really easy. And that's how I feel now. Like now it seems like it was super easy.
Okay, let's ratchet up the pressure then.
What?
The next book.
The next book, I have two solid ideas. I will not tell you or anybody else what they are. I think my husband knows, but he has a very close personal relationship with me. I hope they will be good. Like, to me, this book came together so well. It seems miraculous. So I don't know if lightning strikes twice, I might turn into Mimi.
Yeah, just be a recluse. Just
I'll be hiding in my big old mansion in Bel Air. So, but we'll see. But we'll work on it. So once all this ends, I'll start up again.
So let's talk about psychology, I guess my psychology here for a second.
Oh, let's do. That's fascinating. Tell me more.
Whenever I read a really funny book and people are saying it's really funny and I do laugh when I'm reading it, I always get really sad.
Oh, well, that's where, you know, my husband is a comedy writer. He worked on Beavis and Butthead, as I told you, and he worked on Frasier and many other shows. And they have a saying in the world of comedy, which is comedy is tragedy plus time. And that's why you feel really sad when things are really funny. And there's a whole, like, they discuss comedy a lot in jokes in my book because it's fascinating to me how those two things go together, you know, because Haynes explains to, or maybe Alice explains to Frank about how what makes you laugh about a joke is, you know, you can recognize it's not the way it's supposed to be, and it makes you laugh. So it's one of the many very deep things in my book, like the unicorn and the glass house and the dream house. So,
well, I was thinking about the mathematical properties of that quote. And so if you subtract time, if you have comedy minus tragedy, you have time.
Oh, you're pretty deep too.
if you look at the mathematical equation.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, think about the slapstick movies. People fell down and you would laugh. You know, I remember my sister fell down the stairs once when we were kids, like we were teenagers, I guess. And I was horrified while it was happening. And I was like, oh, my God, are you okay? And she's like, I'm fine. And I started to laugh and I felt terrible. But it's just a natural response. So,
well, once I was playing tennis with a friend and probably a 10-year-old kid was riding his bicycle and he hit a patch of gravel and he had a wreck.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend started to laugh. And I said, come on, stop. That's not fair, man. Don't laugh at that kid. And he goes, man, you're such a buzzkill. And so the kid goes to the same patch of gravel and wrecks
again.
And I start laughing. And he goes, what? I said, he's obviously stupid. So.
Goodness. So anyway.
Well, Julia, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing Frank with us.
Oh, well, you're so nice to have me in your very glamorous studios.
It is
glamorous and lovely and large.
So well appointed as
well. It is magnificently appointed. I will say that. So
thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Julia Claiborne Johnson is the author of Be Frank With Me, which is published by William Morrow. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, wyplfmbooktalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.